You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you're gathered around the radio with your family today, as I always like to imagine you, take a look at your loved ones. There is an image I want to share with you. It's an artwork called Family Romance by the LA sculptor Charles Ray. Now, this sculpture is figurative, realistic. It's a pleasant-looking nuclear family. Mom, dad, two kids. They're all holding hands, but they're nude. Now, there's nothing obscene about it at all. What makes the figures in Family Romance kind of creepy is that the artist has made them 4.5 feet tall. All of them, so that dad and the toddler are the same height. In fact, because she's got those chunky baby limbs, she looks bigger than dad and somehow menacing. Honey, he blew up the kid just enough to be uncanny and a little disturbing. The artist Charles Ray is playing with all of our expectations of scale. Today on Studio 360, we're asking, exactly how and when does size matter in all kinds of art? My guest today for this conversation is the actor Liev Schreiber, who is literally and figuratively towering as an actor, and he can steal a scene while talking quietly. He has done some of the biggest roles in theater, like Hamlet and Henry V in New York, and he also played the title role in Jonathan Demme's remake of The Manchurian Candidate last year. Liev Schreiber talked to me from Prague in the Czech Republic. He was there directing his first film, an adaptation of the best-selling novel Everything is Illuminated. The film comes out this August. I asked him how it feels to go from acting in movies to making one.
It's an incredible experience. First of all, just the sort of Promethean task of actually getting a film through the deal is an incredible feat in and of itself, and you sort of almost want to stop after that part's done, but then you actually have to go on the set, and there's about 200 or 300 people who are sort of waiting to hear what they should do from you, and it's an incredible challenge, and it's actually really exciting and really, really fun.
Is your sort of perspective on this film very, very different than it is being an actor? Because you're like the god looking down on all of your creation. Is that a very different experience?
I think that I've always acted. I mean, not that I don't believe in techniques, really, or styles or methods of acting. I just kind of have always felt like, you know, you do whatever works. And so I think for me, though, if I had to describe the technique that I seem to use most of the time is I'm imagining what the scene should feel like or should look like. And I know a lot of people probably think I've heard a lot of people say that's a bad way to go about it, but it's just the way my head works. I sort of see things from the outside and then go in.
As an actor?
Yeah. I tend to work much better with a sense of perspective than I do from being inside the thing. And I guess that's helped me and to some degree lent me a certain amount of eye towards directing.
Well, that sounds like what directors are supposed to do rather than what actors are supposed to do in conventional wisdom.
Yeah, I think I may have been in the wrong job for a while. But, you know, I actually don't want to say that because, you know, I like acting a lot. And the reality is, you know, we get a lot more money acting, and we work a lot less hours. And I just want to bear that in mind as I become enthusiastic over the next few days about directing.
Now, you also wrote the screenplay, and they get the least money of all.
It's a nightmare.
Did you? Well, I was going to ask you, how was that? Had you written a screenplay before?
Yeah, I'd worked on a couple of screenplays without any success, really, in terms of selling them or anything like that. But I'd been working on a story about my grandfather for a long time, ever since he died, actually, and had written a screenplay about a guy who goes back to Ukraine to find out what it means to be Ukrainian when his grandfather dies. And while I was sort of struggling over that script, rather humorless script, I read Jonathan's short story that he submitted to The New Yorker called The Very Rigid Search. And I felt that he was doing everything that I was trying to do with my script, except that his jokes were better. Mm-hmm. So I called him and asked him if I could steal his jokes. And he said, yeah.
Now, what about the smallness of exquisite film acting versus the bigness that's required on stage? I saw you as Henry V in Central Park last summer. And, you know, it's this big theater out in the, you know, in the middle of the city. That must require just a whole different approach to acting than doing a film.
I think it does. I think there's something incredible about being able to see someone blush for real. I mean, being able to see someone's face fill with blood and become red when they react to something. It's a remarkable thing to see someone's eyes dilate as they look at something. It's just undeniably real, and that's effective to us at a certain level.
Now, when you're acting in a film, are you conscious of, God, my nose is going to be 20 feet high when this is projected? Or do you say, most people are going to see this on TV? I shouldn't worry about that.
If you worry about it or think about it too much, you get in trouble. You know, because I mean, really good film acting is pretty focused. You know, it's if you are trying to get the perspiration on your upper lip or the flushing of the skin or the pupils dilating, you sort of got to really be dialed into what you're thinking about or what you're looking at, because it's so intimate, it's so close. That's also close-up acting, which, by the way, is different than wide acting. There's even scale within film.
Tell me what that means, the difference between close-up acting and wide acting. How does that actually work?
Well, it's very different if you're acting with just your eyes as opposed to acting, you know, with your eyes
and your body,
your mouth, yeah. and then, you know, adding your arms and hands and legs, and it all means a lot. It's like why a lot of actors from film have trouble when they go to theater, because they're not used to moving below the chest.
Huh. I never thought of that. I'm sure that's absolutely true, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, also, their voice is recorded on a radio mic. So they can sort of speak to you at the level I'm speaking to you and be very effective. But the minute they get on the stage, the nearest audience member is a good 25 feet away. And that almost never carries.
So they must feel, people who haven't done theater must go into a theater and, among other things, feel as they have to shout in order to perform.
Right, which feels very artificial to them. But that's, I guess, why plays don't really work on film. I think because you have to accept that suspension of disbelief and feel natural within it. That it's almost like a public speaker. That what you're saying may be better said intimately, but it doesn't carry intimately, so you find a way to be intimate at a larger scale.
My guest today is Liev Schreiber, the actor and now film director, to whom we're talking from his apartment in Prague in the Czech Republic. And we're talking about how actors and other artists choose the right size for the work they do. Our first story today is about a unique demonstration of that principle of scale. It's a 1977 short film by the great designers Charles and Ray Eames, who are best known for their famous chair. Their point in the film was to show how our view of something changes radically according to our distance from it. I saw the film 20 years ago for the first time, and I think it's probably affected the way I've looked at the world ever since. It's called The Powers of Ten, and Chris Spurgeon has this appreciation.
Powers of Ten opens up with a couple having a picnic lunch in a Chicago park. As the man lies down on the picnic blanket for a post-meal nap, the camera, looking down from above, begins to pull back. And then it continues to pull back and keeps pulling back. Every 10 seconds, the camera moves 10 times further away from the picnickers, and the scene gets 10 times wider. All the while, physicist Philip Morrison describes the action.
This square is 10 meters wide. And in 10 seconds, the next square will be 10 times as wide. Our picture will center on the picnickers, even after they've been lost to sight. 100 meters wide. The distance a man can run in 10 seconds. Cars crowd the highway. Powerboats lie at their docks. The colorful bleachers are Soldiers Field.
You may appreciate Scorsese or Altman's camera tracking shots. Forget those. Powers of 10 is the mother of all tracking shots. The camera continues to pull back, up into the air, through the clouds, off the Earth, past the planets, out of the solar system, out of the whole galaxy, into the furthest reaches of outer space. By the time the camera has stopped moving outward, we're at the edge of the universe.
We pass the big Virgo cluster of galaxies, among many others, 100 million light years out. As we approach the limit of our vision, we pause to start back home.
The film then plunges you all this the way back to Earth, scene, back to Chicago, back to the man lying on the blanket. And then the camera keeps pushing in, now getting 10 times closer every 10 seconds, until the film eventually ends inside the nucleus of a single carbon atom, inside a single cell, inside the sleeping man's hand. From start to finish, it's a journey that encompasses 40 powers of 10. This clever and beautiful film has been seen by perhaps 100 million people. It's been shown for decades in everything from art schools to astronomy courses to science museums and film festivals. Eames Demetrius is the grandson of Charles and Ray Eames and the current head of the Eames office. He says the film is still finding new audiences.
We have people who buy our film to use it in business, to start sales meetings, to give as presents after meditation classes. All sorts of different things, and that's because Charles and Ray focused on one pure thing. What happens when you add a zero?
That investigation of what happens when you change scale was a huge part of the Eames work in everything from furniture design to filmmaking. It was a rule of their design process to always look at things from the next smaller and next bigger frames of reference. Demetrius says the real triumph of the powers of 10 is the way it makes these abstract concepts such an immediate direct experience.
I mean, this radio presentation is going to tell you about scale and then maybe even show you in a few ways. But the Powers of 10 film doesn't tell you that one thing is 10 times bigger than another. It shows you. It immerses you in that experience. Now that's part of your, not just part of things you know, but things that you've experienced viscerally.
A quarter century after its release, The Powers of 10 continues to influence filmmakers. Special effects technicians commonly refer to extreme zoom-ins or zoom-outs as Powers of 10 shots, and the Library of Congress has listed The Powers of 10 in its National Film Registry of Significant and Groundbreaking Cinematic Works. But to Eames Demetrius, the importance of the film goes way beyond cinematography.
This is not, you know, necessarily what Charles and Ray were doing, but I think that scale is the new geography. I think that if you don't know geography, you have no place to put all the things that happen in the world. You know, when you read about something happening in Yemen, if you don't know where Yemen is, you're in trouble. I think scale is that way, that if you don't know what a trillion shares means, you're in trouble. If you don't know that anthrax is happening at the scale of 10 to the minus 8, you're missing something because you can't contextualize it with everything else, with the fact that the human organism is roughly 10 to the zero meters. So I really believe it's kind of the new geography, and it's extremely important.
For Studio 360, I'm Chris Spurgeon.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with Liev Schreiber, who is actually not in Studio 360, but in his apartment in Prague. Have you seen Powers of 10, Liev?
No, I haven't, but I have seen the flip book of Powers of 10, and it's an amazing piece. It's really funny because in going through it, it made me think about, for some reason, I have all of these bird's eye POVs in the film I'm shooting now. And, you know, it's driving the producers crazy because, of course, every time you need a bird's eye POV, you're talking about an expensive crane rental for that day to get that shot. But I insisted that all of these shots were bird's eye POVs, and I didn't have a good reason for it. And it was funny, after seeing the book for Powers of 10, I kind of got a sense of maybe what that was for me, which is a sense of perspective on scenes. And it's an unusual perspective, and it's a perspective that, for me, allows you to step back and see the intimate problem with some perspective, some scale, some distance that's a little bit impersonal. And it's really, really interesting.
Yeah,
for me at least.
Well, now you have a theory to give your producers if they keep complaining about this.
Yeah, no, I'm just going to show them the powers of 10. But the thing is, what's important about that is also that you're interested in what's close. And what makes it good is the contrast. What makes it good is not that you just do a bird's eye POV shot, but that you come off an intimate close moment. And the intimate close moment is juxtaposed by something that is distant and slightly unusual in perspective.
What struck me about the film when I first saw it is that to engage in any kind of creative activity, you know, half well, satisfyingly, requires a kind of that kind of jumping back and forth between scales to see something in the biggest sense and be able to sort of zoom your brain, if you will, into the smallest sense, and to be able to make those leaps kind of back and forth 100 times a day if you're trying to write something or make something or do something worth doing.
I was walking through a park here, and you know, the Czechs, they kiss in public a lot, and I was walking through Letna Park, and there was this couple just completely, like, you know, making out. I mean, hot and heavy right in the middle of the park. And it just struck me as, not that I'm, you know, very conservative or anything, but I thought, well, wow, they're really going at it in the middle of the park. And I thought the difference between my perspective of their experience and what it must have felt like for them inside of the experience, and having remembered being in kisses like that myself, and thinking how completely oblivious I am to how this looks from the outside, from a distance walking by. And that kind of shuttling back and forth between the subject and the subjective and the objective is really, really interesting to me. And I think that's kind of what Power of 10 does. That to me is the beginning and the end of that narrative. It's still incredibly based in humanity.
Right.
We start on a man's DNA. We go to this, you know, incredible projection of the galaxy, and then we ultimately come back to a human being, that we go away only to come back to ourselves.
Liev Schreiber is my guest today, and we're talking about making movies on a big or small scale. And in a second, we'll hear about some paintings too big to fit on almost anybody's walls. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. And by Hofstra University, continuing its Great Writers, Great Reading series, where some of America's most eminent writers read from their own works. More details at hofstra.edu.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is the actor and director Liev Schreiber. We're talking about how artists, musicians, and filmmakers all mess around with scale in their work. A few hundred years ago, the biggest commission a painter could get was to decorate the wall of a church in fresco, or in Michelangelo's case, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican. A job like this meant you had made it big in all senses. But today it's common for even unknown young painters to work very large, to take over the biggest wall in a gallery and paint something that only a Medici could fit in his living room. Matt Holtzman of KCRW tried to find out why it is that modern painters turn monumental.
We saw the first really big art of the modern era when the church commissioned works about God, the Virgin Mary, and that crowd. Artists had big subjects, they had big spaces, and they had time and money. Think of Titian's 22-foot-tall Assumption of the Virgin Mary. Art just couldn't get any bigger as long as artists were being so literal. Even a picture of the Virgin Mary is a little creepy when it gets too big. It's only when art moved away from representation that something really big could happen. Stephanie Barron is chief curator of modern and contemporary art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
beginning in the 50s, we moved into abstraction. And there's a big difference. There are no set boundaries. You're not telling a story from left to right or top to bottom. And it's only the ambition of the idea that puts a limit on it.
Think of that picture of Jackson Pollock leaning over his canvas on the floor with his legs spread, paint in one hand and brush in the other. The painting is about 18 feet long, or about 3 times the size of the guy painting it.
There's a reason that that photograph has become so famous, because it's about Pollock almost being in the canvas and expressing his emotion directly onto the canvas. It's very different than a rather measured painting done on the easel, on the wall, where you step back and you go forward and you're very carefully calibrating what's going on.
Theoretically, art had been freed to grow as big as the biggest human emotion. But there were still practical considerations. Remember, artists didn't have patrons anymore, and bigger work cost more to make.
You need a large studio, you need a large gallery, you need either a collector who has a kind of jumbo exhibition space, or a museum. So there are all those issues that come into play with the care and feeding, shall we say, of large-scale works of art.
After the war, New York became the epicenter of the art world. Manufacturing was fleeing Manhattan, and galleries began to move into the industrial spaces they left behind. Pat Four was an artist at the time and has now owned a gallery for more than 30 years. I talk with Pat and the artist Karen Carson at Bergamot Station, a gallery complex in Santa Monica.
In the late 40s, real estate on 57th Street became so expensive that people had moved to kind of industrial areas where the spaces were large. They were large and cheap. And I saw this show there, and it was in this huge vacant space with enormous paintings to fill up the space. Yeah. Because they could. They couldn't before. Right. I don't even think they thought about it before. They saw the space, and they filled it.
Abstract expressionists like Jackson Pollock had opened the floodgates for bigger art from then on. Minimalist Ellsworth Kelly created colorful geometric paintings as big as an 18-wheeler. Pop artist Klaus Oldenburg made an ice pack big enough for King Kong's headaches. And land artist Michael Heiser's 9 Nevada Depressions looks like God doodled in the desert with a stick. The artist Karen Carson says there's a movie that explains this need to work big.
Have you seen The Horse's Mouth?
Yeah, I did.
Well, it's Gully Jimson is the name of the artist that Alec Guinness plays, and he is an inveterate painter who always needs large spaces, and he never has it. He lives on a houseboat. So every time Gully sees a huge white wall, he has to paint it.
That wall. It's rather bare, I'm afraid. That's the wall I want. I've dreamt of a wall like that.
I was a kid when I saw that movie. I was in high school, and it completely explained to me what art was all about. It was like filling up spaces, and the bigger the better. It's part of making yourself larger than who you are, so it's a huge amount of ego involved.
Can you remember an artist who decided to go large because they could, but whose work did not support the size?
Probably most of them. But I don't want to name names, do I?
When I was growing up and I was a young artist, I thought if you were a man, you made a big picture.
If you were an unafraid man, you could make a really tiny picture.
Exactly.
Karen Carson's current work at the Rosamund Felsen Gallery at Bergamot Station is about the terrible beauty of the recent California brush fires. One painting, filled with swirls of lurid red and day-glow orange, is 21 feet long and covers almost an entire gallery wall. Why did you decide to make it this size?
Because I wanted to make them more scary, and also I knew I had a space that I could show them in. That does make a difference.
In the same room, there are 3 smaller paintings that are more human-sized. I asked Karen why she made some of the work smaller if the subject demanded larger scale.
I would make a couple of very large paintings and then make satellite works that are smaller, because if people see something that's really large that they really love but they can't afford it, they always would like to buy a smaller version. It's like souvenirs. So you buy like you buy a souvenir of where you went on your vacation. Something should be taken away.
You can't take much away from the newest, biggest art. In fact, most people won't even get a chance to see it. For instance, if you didn't get to London in the last 6 months, you missed the weather project at the Tate Modern. This artificial weather system filled the Tate's football field-sized turbine hall with artist-made sun and artist-made mist. But the weather project is so big and so site-specific that now that it's gone, it's really gone, except in the exhibition catalog and on the Tate's website. It's kind of funny. As art gets bigger, it seems like it only lives on in pictures small enough to fit in a coffee table book. For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
You can see images of Karen Carson's giant brush fire paintings at studio360.org, which we have reduced to fit on normal-sized computer screens. I'm Kurt Anderson today with the actor and director Liev Schreiber. Liev, I wonder about the artist Karen Carson's observation that men are driven to make big pictures. Do you think that's true?
I was afraid you were going to say that. I don't know. I don't know that. I mean, but that's coming from a woman who's just finished a 26-foot painting. I don't know that size matters with the sexes. I suppose.
As we listened to that, I was struck by the mention of Klaus Oldenburg, who, as a kid, when I first saw pictures of and then encountered the real things of the you know, 17-foot badminton birdies and they're in Philadelphia, this 45-foot tall clothespin, I loved those in their kind of toy-like quality. And I wonder why it is that we are so drawn to things that are out of scale sometimes. And I wonder is there art of any kind that either very small or very large that you find appealing?
I really, really love those giant things too. And I find them riveting. And I think it's because they terrify me. I think I get really scared about scale. And I think that size does matter. And, you know, you see a 40-foot, or how I forgot how big the clothespin was.
45-foot tall,
and I remember
yeah.
the badminton birdie.
Yeah.
It just, you know what it reminds me of? What was that movie about the Martian invasion?
Oh, you mean
with the big robot with the visor and the it's a
cult
film.
The day the Earth stood still. You mean
yes, the day the Earth stood still. For some reason, every time I see one of those Oldenburgs, I think of for some reason the day the Earth stood still, and I guess the connection for me is scale that we are relatively small in comparison to things, and we take sort of simple mundane objects from our own life, and throw them out of proportion size-wise. It reminds us of our own limitations and size, and I for some reason I really like that kind of emotional punishment.
No, I do too. And I speaking of that combination of fear and thrill, it's similar mm-hmm. to what I get again, just looking up, laying outside, looking up at the stars at night, mm-hmm. and imagining how tiny and insignificant and how vast the creation is. It's the same sort of quasi-religious, terrifying thrill, I think.
It's a great example because it's terrifying, and at the same time, it's really, really soothing because it feels like there is an order and a continuity for some reason that you are where you should be, and this is how it, and things are as they should be, and you have a distance on your own problems.
My guest today is Liev Schreiber, and we're talking about the scale that artists choose for their work. songs don't take up any physical space, but there are certainly big songs and little songs. Musicians and their producers have to make all kinds of choices about the number of instruments and how loud they play. Sometimes even the size of the room can make or break a song. Mark Stewart records under the name Stu and writes elegant, classic-sounding rock and pop tunes. He's constantly making the choice between simple and complex. Stu and his writing partner, Heidi Rodewald, talk to us from their studio in Los Angeles about how that works.
Small is always the thing that gets the attention. Maybe when I was 22, I would have told you, no, a really slamming drummer with a wife beater t-shirt and sweating, and with everybody rocking their heads in unison, that's the thing that gets your attention, you know. This whole thing about scale really is kind of sums up our whole career, because our old band, The Negro Problem, was pretty much about the kitchen sink, you know, throwing in anything you could. You know, we would put in bagpipes and harpsichords and mellotrons and millions of background vocals. With the last record we made, Something Deeper Than These Changes, they were pretty much quiet, laid-back arrangements. Before, I used to write songs about, like, ideas, you know. And these recent songs were actually about real things, real people. Those stories sort of needed the space to be heard, you know. Curiosity. Nowadays, he just talks about the company. Good love should be just like a weekend getaway. But she gotta go home somewhere to someone someday. Let the choir say,
love, love, love is a way of life, my love. Ooh. Love, love, love is a way of life, my love.
The song that we're dealing with today, Gold Digger, it's basically like a novelty song. It's not really a serious tune. It's just sort of a novelty song about some sort of sleazy character in Las Vegas. One thing we're doing today will be just kind of reading the story, actually, just reading the lyric. I was cruising the main drag in my psychedelic jag, the convertible kind. She was in the left lane. I said, baby, what's your game? She said, stakes are high. Well, she looked like she stepped out of a dream, and then she stepped into my love machine. I guess that you could say she was bold. Here's a story that must be told. The gold digger had a heart of gold.
I was cruising the main drag in my psychedelic jag, the convertible kind. She was in the left lane. I said, baby, what's your game? She said, stakes are high. Well, she looked like she stepped out of a dream, and then she stepped into my love machine.
The acoustic version of the song Gold Digger, the thing I love about intimate acoustic songs with a ton of reverb, which is what they used to do a lot in the old days, in the late 60s, is you kind of get the best of both worlds. You get this intimate picture, but the reverb makes it sound like you're in this giant desert, you know. This little song gets to sound like a landscape, you know. The studio kind of has a way, I think, of distorting scale. Do you know what I mean? You know, you can take a giant band, giant rock band, and compress it to make it sound like it's coming out of a little radio. And you can take one guy with a guitar and a voice and make him sound like he's, you know, coming down off the clouds.
Here's a story that must be told. That gold digger had a heart of gold. Here's a story that must be told. That gold digger had a heart of gold.
I love hearing other instruments noodling around, and it's up to somebody else to say, it's done, you know. Now you're messing it up. In our band, that's actually Heidi's role, I think.
Yeah, it's like I'm an outsider. It's a lot easier to see it. Not adding things to make it sound better, not to mess the vibe up. We started with.
Yeah. The women that I've played music with, and Heidi in particular, tend to go, hey, wait a minute, you know. The point of this is the story, the vocal, not the big construction site of music that you're trying to build here.
I was was cruising the main drag in my psychedelic Jag, the convertible kind. He was in the left lane. I said, baby, what's your game? He said, stakes are high. Well, he looked like he stepped out of a dream, and then he stepped into my love machine.
We were just working on Heidi's record, and I thought that the Gold Digger song to me was this kind of ultimate sort of macho tune, and just to flip that.
The Gold Digger had a heart of gold.
The bigger production to me somehow seems more cynical. It's funny, because you're talking about the exact same thing. These two people who sort of have less than proper designs, you know, on each other. But for some reason, singing about it in this quiet, sort of mellow way makes it all seem very sensitive. But you take the exact same lyric and put it to this kind of peppy beat, because we're giving the story less voice, we're giving the story less space. We're just sort of almost walking over the story to give you our groovy little production, you know, and in a way that gives even more edge to me to the story.
I had a little cash but no flow. Here's a story that must be told. The Gold Digger had a heart of gold. Here's a story that must be told. The Gold Digger had a heart of gold. I was working in a lounge on the other side of town, making beautiful noise. Soon he saw right through my drama. Couldn't be his sugar mama. Couldn't buy him no toys. So I sat him at a table with a real stiff drink, and then my groove wrapped around him like a brand new mink. And now it's him I'm putting on hold. I got a story that must be told.
That's Heidi Rodewald on vocals and her songwriting partner, Stu. Their most recent album is called Something Deeper Than These Changes. And you can hear the rest of that song, Gold Digger, at studio360.org. Jocelyn Gonzalez produced our story. My guest today is Liev Schreiber, and we're talking about the scale that artists choose for their work. Liev, I thought it was really interesting when Stu said that small is always the thing that gets the attention. It sort of sounds like what you were saying earlier about acting in film.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very interesting observation, too, about how you kind of cheapen the song by kind of making it kind of, you know, funkier, more production-oriented.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
It was interesting both to hear the production sort of stuff laid on it increase, but also the gender flipping was an interesting combination. As a music fan, would you rather be in a big stadium hearing a band you love, or in a little club hearing them play unplugged?
I'm gonna make major sacrilege here. I would rather be hearing it on a stereo in my room.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you're an agoraphobic and you just don't like being out.
No, it's personal to me. I don't know. I mean, I'm oddly shy too for an actor, and I don't know. I think, when you're out, you're expected to dance or respond to the music, or to have other people see you respond to the music.
Yeah,
it's somehow, you know, that experience of, oh, do you like it? Do you like it? Well, yeah, I like it. Shut up. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I, music that I really, really love, I sort of like to listen to alone.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. When we come back, we'll hear more from my conversation with Liev Schreiber, and we'll also hear how a bad habit taught a jazz musician to love the sound of steel guitar. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. My guest today is the actor and director Liev Schreiber, and we're talking about how artists play with scale. Liev, you've gone from being a great star within the independent film world and on the stage in New York to now being a certifiably hot actor in Hollywood and now getting your chance to direct. Do you think about the scale of your personal ambition, what it is you want to do? Is, and I know you played Orson Welles once. Do you have a Wellesian ambition?
No, I wish I had a Wellesian ambition. I have a much more shallow ambition, or at least I started with a much more shallow ambition. I think about that kind of stuff a lot because, you know, those kinds of thoughts and those kinds of feelings are very good for motivating acting. But, you know, I always felt isolated. There was a movie with Yul Brynner that I saw years ago called Westworld.
Sure.
In which Richard Benjamin plays a guy who goes on a vacation where you can interact with this world of people and they're all robots. And at one point, Yul Brynner's faceplate comes off and you see that it's all circuitry and lights. And I think when I was a kid, I used to believe at a certain level, I guess it's called megalomania, but I used to believe that if I cut someone else open, that there would just be circuitry. And I had that kind of sense of myself as being very isolated. And I think that that was actually really scary to me. And I think initially the idea about acting or the idea about performing was about wanting to feel more connected. And if you're lucky enough to work with the right writers and the right directors and the right actors, you get bigger perspectives and you get greater scale, and that changes and allows you to see beyond some of the things that, you know, were driving you in the past. And I think for me, my grandfather's death kind of did that. He was sort of the big male figure in my life and someone I loved very much and identified with very, very, very deeply. And when he died, I suddenly thought, well, what was it that I was identifying with? Who is that? What is it to be a man, to be a person, to be a human being? And then when he died, I suddenly started to analyze, well, who was he? You know, he was this Ukrainian, Polish, Jewish immigrant who came to New York and, you know, worked in the meat market, but was also a cellist and also collected wood carvings and a really, really interesting guy. And I realized I didn't know anything about who he was at all. And I think that I started to actually get my wish of feeling connected to people when I started to try to connect with someone other than myself.
And now you know that the rest of us are not robots.
Yeah, well, I realized that my grandfather wasn't, so the rest of you must not be.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It took me a while.
Liev Schreiber, it has been a complete pleasure to talk to you today. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Liev Schreiber's directorial debut, his film adaptation of the novel Everything is Illuminated, will be in theaters this August. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. When I was young, I watched a lot of television. A good 4 or 5 hours on an average weekday, from the moment I got home, Looney Tunes right after school, to the Twilight Zone before bedtime. But then I grew up and TV lost its spell over me. Sure, I continued to watch occasionally, like a recovered addict, in moderation. Just enough to realize sometime during the 1990s that TV was suddenly, shockingly good. I'm not talking about cable TV. Back in the mid-90s, there was no such thing as a cable show that everyone talked about, that you had to watch. Television in the 90s was defined by smart, well-written, prime-time network sitcoms like Roseanne, Murphy Brown, Seinfeld, and, of course, The Simpsons.
Well, I've always been a firm believer in the 3 R's. Reading TV Guide, writing to TV Guide, and renewing TV Guide.
But in the 90s, the best shows were also, by and large, the most highly rated shows. That had never happened before. And mainstream TV was arguably superior to mainstream motion pictures. That had never happened before either. Looking at the Nielsen Top 10 in the 90s actually used to make me feel a little better about my fellow Americans. Western civilization wasn't necessarily in decline. But that golden age, like all golden ages, was too good to last. In 1999, among the top shows were still ER, Frasier, Friends, 60 Minutes, and The X-Files. But then, within just a couple of seasons, the highest-rated programs were mostly not so good.
If I were ever pass you along in life again, and you were laying there dying of thirst, I would not give you a drink of water. I would let the vultures take you and do whatever they want with you, with no ill regrets.
And ever since, most of the shows at the top of the ratings heap have been mediocre series like CSI and all of its spin-offs, or Everybody Loves Raymond, or Law & Order and all of its spin-offs, and reality shows like Survivor, American Idol, The Apprentice, and Extreme Makeover. Frasier and Friends have gone off the air. There is Desperate Housewives, but the last excellent primetime network drama still running, West Wing, was created 5 years ago, back in the 90s. So what happened? Some of this is just a matter of inevitable, uncontrollable boom and bust cycles, like farming. We're in a drought. But there's also an unmistakable generational underpinning to this trend line. When the 90s began, baby boomers were 25 to 44 years old. In other words, practically all the people creating TV were, for the first and last time, members of the first generation that grew up watching television. The generation that thought they could and would do everything better than their parents had. And at the same time, baby boomers back then were the desirable TV viewers because we all fell into the only age group that advertisers really care about. Meaning that one more time, as with rock and roll back in the 60s and 70s, boomers in the 90s were responsible for a big, brilliant, groundbreaking pop culture moment that hasn't been equaled since. But before anybody gets too self-satisfied, it is also baby boomers who are now running the broadcast networks, choosing the shows that go on the air. And in response to the rise of cable TV, those big network executives are running scared and making panicky, safe, second-guessed, uncreative programming choices in favor of the dumb and the bland. In other words, it may have been baby boomers who made primetime great in the 1990s, but it is also baby boomers who are turning network TV back into an unsatisfying wasteland today.
That wasn't very good at all. Really, really, really bad.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. You may have heard the music of Chaz Smith, but you probably didn't realize it. He's a big soundtrack player. He performed on the scores to Finding Nemo and American Beauty and The Shawshank Redemption, among many others. But Chaz Smith's not a scene stealer. He keeps his pedal steel guitar sighing and whining softly in the background. In the music he writes and performs himself, Smith creates a slow-moving, textured flow of sounds from different kinds of guitars and these fantastical, dangerous-looking instruments he builds himself, sometimes out of surplus titanium from the California aerospace plants. To close the show today, Chaz Smith tells us how an accident of fate and a bad habit led him to his calling.
I went to Berklee Music in Boston in 69-70, and I was went there to study jazz composition and arranging. lot of notes, a lot of chords, a lot of movement, a lot of activity. And I wanted to be the next Bill Evans, and I really didn't have it. I just didn't have it. I don't solo well, and I mean, nobody else is the next Bill Evans either, but I really was disillusioned in my my playing skills. At the time, I used to drink a bit, and I was on the floor of the apartment, and the wife and the friends were going out somewhere to get something. I don't know what it was, and I couldn't move, and I was just lying there. And one of the friends had left a recording of Waylon Jennings' Honky Tonk Heroes on the turntable. Now, back up. Because I studied jazz, I was actually headed to California, and we got as far as New Orleans, ran out of money, and stayed there for a while, and then we moved to Georgia. So I was surrounded by country music, and I absolutely despised it. And I don't know whether I despised it because of the geography, and I didn't want to be there, I wanted to be in California, or I just didn't like the sounds, or whatever it was, or it was a combination of everything. So I'm lying on the floor, and there's a Waylon Jennings record going over and over and over, and I can't get up to take it off. And so I'm lying there on the floor listening and listening and listening, and Ralph Mooney was a steel player. And the sound that came out of that steel guitar was raw, but with emotion, and it just captured me. And it kept playing, and I couldn't get it to shut it off. And the more I listened to it, I'm like, God, what is that sound? Yeah. And so after that, I bought every record I could get that had steel guitar on it. About 1978, I went out and bought one and started the odyssey of learning how to play it. Probably the best thing I ever did. Well, it's very difficult, and when you're first starting, it is deadly. It's whiny. I can't hit the notes right. We were living in this house between two apartment buildings. Well, the neighbors in the apartment building would throw their garbage over the fence into our yard as a appreciation for my skills, and so it's a long haul. Very, and it can be very, very, very discouraging. So it's recommended that you be obsessive-compulsive to some degree to take it up. I mean, I'm sure there's something that's more complicated, but, you know, I don't know what it is, and I can't imagine why you'd want to play it. If the guitar is tuned to a something chord, like an E chord, and you move the bar up and down the frets, so you're kind of stuck with triadic, you know, E triads, now A triads, now B triads, depending on whether you're on open or on the fifth fret or the seventh fret. So to change that, start squeezing pedals and knee levers, and that changes the actual chord while you're playing. So it's a choreography of both feet, both hands, both knees happening all the time. And, you know, when you listen to country music and you hear what appear to be fairly simple lines or very simple lyrical things coming out of steel guitar, the guy that's playing it is doing a whole choreography and acrobatics to make that sound happen. One of the things about country music that goes back to like bluegrass is the high lonesome sound, and is usually associated with Bill Monroe and music from the Hollers, and it's a plaintive sound. The crying, the wailing, I mean, are right there, you know, and easily accessible. And because it's not a fixed pitch instrument, it can approximate a vocal line. You know, in this culture, men tend to don't have a lot of emotions, or we aren't trained to have emotions, or, you know, my girlfriend asks, oh, what are you feeling? Well, how would I know? I'm a man, you know, I go to a therapist and pay him to tell me what I'm feeling. And so The thing with this, with a steel guitar, it's a very emotional instrument. When it's successful for me, it's like looking at a tapestry where it just kind of hangs in the air, and you can see the interplay of all the layers and all the details, and there's like a lot of stuff in there to look at. And for me, if each time I come back and listen to it, I see different stuff or see different layers or different combinations, that to me makes it a lot more interesting, I think. It's not a very good description now, is it?
Composer Chaz Smith. His most recent record is An Hour Out of Desert Center. Studio 360's David Krasnow produced our story. If a song by Waylon Jennings or anybody else ever changed your life, please let us know about it. You can reach us through our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you have been listening to Studio 360 today, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Brad Titel,
John Boyle,
Lauren Shea,
Elizabeth Rich.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Obsessive office memos from the producer of Gone with the Wind.
I spoke today to Walter Plunkett about Gable's costumes. There's no excuse for their fitting him so badly. I think the trick about collars on anyone with a large neck is to make the collars slightly large so that they don't press against the neck and make it look as though it's bulging.
I'm Kurt Anderson, the art of writing letters. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.